Hello, everybody. This is the Gingerbread Man, and I would like to welcome you to my home. It's really nice to see you again, you know, all your smiling faces. So I guess some of you might be cringing, waiting for what's going to happen. I'm certainly nervous. This is a very important episode to me. The subject material concerns an old dead dude, as my roommate would say. Every time I get a new book, it's like when I order books over on the mail, sometimes they'll take a while to show up. And when I do finally get them, I'm always very excited, and then I'll parade them around the house and just show them to everybody, including the dog. And I'm just like, look at my new book. I'm so excited, you know. And then my roommate will go, oh, there's another dead dude, you know. And like most of the time it is, you know. I think, and like the way I think, I mean like in the words in my head come across as like 1700s, like when I think sometimes. But that's all right, you know. So we're going to be talking about Ludwig Wittgenstein today. And he is a philosopher who was born April 26th, 1889 in Vienna, Austria. I didn't look too much more into the details of his life. What's funny is, like, you know, I get really attached to these thinkers and I always put a face to them, but I do not often look too much into the honest, you know, like their actual lives, like what they did. You know, some of them I do, you know, like I'm obsessed with Socrates, but I didn't dig much further past his birth date and where he was born, which is Vienna, Austria. I know that he died in the United Kingdom and that he taught at Cambridge for several years. Three of his four brothers committed suicide, which probably had something to do with the fact that he was quite depressed most of his life. Many people commented on this. And interestingly enough, he went to the same school as Adolf Hitler. So there's actually some conspiracy theorists out there that I've read that said that Hitler could have been drawn to hate Jewish people because, I guess it's kind of weird because I didn't even look in to verify whether Wittgenstein was Jewish or not. I'm not sure. Maybe he is. So don't quote me. I don't look into that much. So, but it's possible that Hitler wanted to kill everybody because of Wittgenstein, because Wittgenstein was just insufferable. You know, he was very misunderstood. And a lot of people nowadays are struggling to even make sense of what he meant. And he's one of those philosophers that people will disagree over the same line where it's literally cats and dogs or apples and oranges. Like, and I'm not even joking. Like, people will have big disagreements over what this guy meant, which, you know, I have always just found confounding. Those are my favorite people. He has a very interesting way of writing. Like, I would have liked to hear him speak. You know, I guess I could. I'm not sure if he. I assumed he probably spoke English working at Cambridge. Wow, I'm ignorant. I'm sorry. Anyways, let's get into the ideas, because this is what I am much, much, much better at. So, again, I'm nervous. I hope I do these ideas justice. This man's mind was just insane. You know, it's one of these writings when I picked it up that I immediately got very attached to it. You know, so I guess I should even put out what reading material I'm basing this off of. So this is On Certainty, which was edited by G.E.M. Anscombe and G.H.Von Wright. It's part of Harper Torch Books. You know, it is copyrighted 1969 by Basil Blackwell. All rights reserved, blah, blah, blah. I'm not supposed to be quoting it, but I'm going to do it. And it's because this is for purely educational purposes. As I've said numerous times, I don't make any money off this. If anything, I pay money for it. So it's not like I'm profiting off of any of these ideas. I'm simply trying to share them if anybody tries to bone me. So, yeah, On Certainty. He has another one. I think it's called Tractatus Logicus Philosophicus or something crazy like that, like some fucking Latin dichotomous name for a book, you know, because that's just how obscure this guy is, you know. So we're dealing with the idea of certainty today, and I guess this is a great time to dig into certainty. Yeah, duh, that's what we're doing. All right, so belief and knowing is one of these key ideas that I picked out pretty quickly, and it's interesting because most skeptics, anybody with a skeptical bend, is going to have a distaste for anybody trying to say they know something, you know? And so I've always been kind of like a beliefist, like even in my writing when I'm arguing with somebody, I guess I've kind of slipped out of it, but I try to implement the strategy of, I believe this, that's how I talk. I believe that this is this, I believe that. This is one of my beliefs, you know? It's not like, I know, I read, you know? Like knowing to me seems to be almost this feeling, like this feeling of conviction that comes with things. Like when you're approached with something, there's a feeling that comes when somebody comes to you. And sometimes you hear people say some outrageous shit, and maybe it's only outrageous because, you know, like it's going against the grain of what I'm already believing. You know, but, and I guess it's so complex. This is such an obscure subject, and I hope I do it justice. So this feeling, this conviction when you hear something of, oh, that sounds right, you know, like, what is rightness? Like, he beats these words with a dead horse throughout this whole book, and it's only like 80 pages, but it took me like a month to read. Like, no bullshit, because I'd get through like 4 or 5 pages in an hour, because I'd have to reread shit like 10 times, you know? Like, so there's a point in the beginning of the book where he literally says that you cannot deny somebody believing anything. You know, like, if I believe something, I can believe the earth is flat, for instance, not to beat another dead horse, or I could believe that satellites don't exist, or I could believe that unicorns are underground in secret caverns with a small group of troll-like creatures named Cambrids that ride these unicorns and then shave off these unicorn horns into a magic pixie dust that they then snort and then, while high, go fuck with the humans on the subsurface. I could believe anything I fucking want to. Like, at the end of the day, like, and somebody's beliefs don't really harm them per se, you know? And I feel like that's what Ludwig was getting into, was that you can't deny anybody's belief. But when somebody approaches you saying, I know this, that is a separate situation completely, you know? And that's when you start to ask for evidence, or you start to ask for some sort of empirical basis. And, you know, often I realize that I don't have any empirical basis. And so I'm trying to put those little tidbits in when I say something that could be taken as outrageous by somebody else that I believe. I'm like, I don't have any evidence for this. This is just a strong conviction that I'm putting out because it feels right. Because that's a lot more honest than saying, I know that this is why, you know, like, there's another section that Wig gets into where he's talking about when you're telling somebody about knowing something, and even if it's not a disagreement, but like you're saying something with conviction, there's a persuasive element to it where it's almost a sales pitch. This is why the world is this way. This is why this feels righter than what you thought was right. You know, because there's always an opportunity for you to hold a conviction in something and even argue it one day, and then coming across and somebody may come up to you and say something that you hear and you're just like, wow, that sounds better than what I was thinking. And it might just happen, you know, without much intrusive persuasion. But the element of saying a knowing is persuasive. There's a sales pitch. At least Wig believes this. And I'm partial to feel similarly. Yeah. So, and then there's a part that he got me really good, and I'm going to read out the note that I took on it when I actually got to that section. It's pretty comical. But I said, chapter 47, Lude, one of the things I called him Lude and Wig. I always give him like little nicknames when I'm writing. So I don't have, because like some people have just stupid names. If I wrote Wittgenstein every time, or his whole name, they get tiring. So I says, Lude calls me out directly, ... What am I doing? ... Asterisk. When I put pen to paper, I'm not trying to repeat what this source or any other source tells me. My goal is to use, selfishly, my source to reflect on my own beliefs. I have said it before, I am a computer dependent upon inputs and calculations. This is me talking about myself. You know, so it's like, when I take notes on any writing, especially something that's good that invigorates me, you know, I'm not paraphrasing or summarizing. Like maybe sometimes, like a lot of this factual information that I get off Google or Wikipedia, you know, for like his birth date, you know, that's factual rote information that you're going to end up writing down. But 99% of my note taking is like I read something and I'm putting it through this filter, a feeling, and then I spit out how I felt about what this other person thought, even though they might have been dead for 100 or 300 or 50 years or whatever. And like that's why I sound like a computer, because it's an input. You know, I put in philosophy or science or parenting book or fiction or pretty art or whatever, and then I get out this like my projection, like a light projector, like a film projector. It's like the light is the source, the book or whatever I'm exposing myself to, and then I am the film reel, and then what I write down or what I say or what I feel afterwards is the projection on the wall. I don't know if that makes any sense, but I feel strongly about that with conviction, because those are my beliefs and I'm allowed to have those. So we're going to segue into a new idea. I really, really enjoyed one of his concepts that he called degrees of certainty. Like, so the picture on the front of this book, which you can look on if you just Google it right away, it's the first picture you'll see show up, and it's just a hand of this like faded out trippy hand, like three of them on top of each other fading out, and they're all weird. Looks like it's melting. And he starts out here. It's a good time. I'll just read like the first segment or two from the book. If you do know that here is one hand, we'll grant you all the rest. Wheel. He says we, like he's like fucking a crowd of people. When one says that such and such a proposition can be proved, of course that does not mean that it can't be derived from other propositions. Any proposition can be derived from other ones, but they may be no more certain than it itself. On this curious remark. Segment two. From it seeming to me, seeming, or to everyone, to be so, it doesn't follow that it is so. What we can ask is whether it can make sense to doubt it. So he's pulling up two major themes. He circles around these ideas, these major themes. And two that I see automatically is that he has these propositions. A proposition is like a claim about something. And things can be predicated upon one another. You know, or maybe you don't. Maybe you do. Like, my consciousness is dependent upon me being awake to an extent. Maybe that's not a good example. Way too obscure, Brandon. All right. Chocolate is dependent upon a chocolatey flavor. Computer is dependent upon electricity to run. If it's out of battery, it fucking dies. You know, it's predicated upon each other. You know, so propositions depend upon one another, they lean upon one another, and networks of propositions are what form ideas about things. And these are built upon sensory data that we can sense about things. And then we it's like a building block is what he's hinting to, is that, so he says, if you can prove that this is my hand, we'll give you the rest, because that's the basis of certainty, is something very obvious. And so imagine a scale here, and on one side of the scale is very, 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 very certain. You know, like, and of course there's also doubt where something's like, oh, I don't, that's very uncertain. But just imagine, like, so very, very, very certain is this is my hand. You know, like, look at your hand right now, feel it, you know, like, it's not even something you really think about a lot. When something is very certain, you don't consider it. When something is very certain, it's habituated. When you're very certain, you don't even consider uncertainty. So now, imagine you're with a friend and you look over upon a hill way off in the distance and you see a weird shape and you say, I think that's a tree. I feel that's a tree. Maybe that's a tree. But imagine this person's very confident and they're like, I know that's a tree, you know? And then it's very foggy and you're like, well, is it a tree? You know, there's that wavering, like, yeah, it could be a tree. Or maybe it's a tree. And that's what I would honestly try to put out that maybe first. You know, but if somebody comes across in that degree of certainty where it's a little shady and you don't know if you're uncertain or if you're certain, you're right in the middle of that path. And if somebody comes upon you and says, I know, and they approach you with knowledge about something that doesn't have complete certainty, like my hand, you know, like what things can we be so certain about as this is my hand or this is my chest, you know, our bodies, our physical material. And I don't think that's it. You know, I think that's a basis of reality. We start out with material, and I think we go past that as we grow. You know, at least I've become very abstract to the point that, you know, I know that I'm dependent upon my body and I'm going to take care of it, but there's far more important I'm still so uncertain on my own philosophy when it comes to these very obscure, like what is a soul, what is a spark, you know, and I'm just still not sure yet. But I do know that it's not all just about the body, which is why I am always very doubtful of certainty and even my own certainty, because I know that my certainty is built upon these sensible objects, these sensible things that I've sensed in the past. And I built these propositions and entangled them together to knit this mitten of rationality to be able to pick up the hot coals of life, you know, and to maneuver, because you have to have some sort of logic to do that. So degrees of certainty. There's not just certain or uncertain. There is a bajillion shades of certainties, and you can be very certain about things, and something you're certain about now might change in the future, you know, which this is going to be fun. So meanings of words, you know, so this is my hand. I'm certain of the word the, you know, I'm certain that my name is the gingerbread man, you know, like, I've never doubted that ever since I was a child, since I was 3 years old and my first speak bubbles. That was one of the first things I said when I was a child, was I am the gingerbread man. And my dad was very shocked. No, I'm kidding. But like the concept, once you learn these words, how to speak, you know, and then we learn how to symbolize them. And speaking and writing are so fucking different. Like being able to make symbols and make art and being able to voice vocal identifications for our world that is taught to us, you know, like those are drastically different things, maybe so pseudo connected. But is I different from the gingerbread man? When I say I love you, I love this world, I love our species, I love my son, I love my family, I love my friends, all of those sentences start with I am the gingerbread man. Are those the same thing? But other people can use I too. So where does the identity come from? Where do we put that composition onto the word? Yet we can't doubt it, you know? And if I were to come across to you and say, maybe I am not the gingerbread man. No, I'm going to say it really confidently. Hey, you, I don't think I'm the gingerbread man anymore. You might think I'm insane. You know, like that's way out of left fucking field, right? So Wig gets onto these points where he's very bent on what he calls rules. And we're going to get into game theory more a little bit later. But the meanings of words are rules, you know, and we have games, but games change and we can make new games and we can make up new rules for new games, which is a major concept. Like, and so how are we learning these rules? And are they learned rules, or are we born with these rules? Do we have natural inclement to accept a logic that is born in us? And, you know, many God-fearing people and even many very scientific non-God-fearing people would say it's genetically encoded in us, many of our behaviors, you know, but are they learned rules, or are we born with these rules built in our heads, or is it a mixture of both? And do words evolve? I really like this concept of how words slowly augment and change and become more efficient, maybe, or maybe not, you know, but they switch and change to be able to suit their environment with time very quickly. You know, I'm often captivated by how people in the 50s and 60s had a very flowery way of talking, you know, and then you hear people who are alive in those time periods talking now and they don't sound like that anymore, because even their vernacular has changed and even their way of speech has changed. And I find that so interesting. Like, so I went to a website called Mental Floss, which is very upscale. You know, it's good for what I got out of it. So these are some sayings that have evolved with time or just don't exist anymore. I think mostly just don't exist. So the first one that I really liked was called Pangwangle. What do you think Pangwangle means? I'll give you a second. What would you, is it like some sort of weird, I don't even know what a pang is. I'm having a hard time. Wangle sounds dirty. So I'm trying to stay out of the gutter here. But to Pangwangle means to live or to go along cheerfully in spite of misfortune. Isn't that nice? Hey, Sally, what are you doing over there? Oh, Jim, I'm just pangwangling. I've been pangwangling since 6:30 this morning. You know, I woke up too early, but I decided to have a good morning and a nice cup of coffee. Oh, shit, Sally. I think I'm going to pangwangle after seeing you pangwangle so nicely. You know, like, that's just so another one is a butter and egg man. Like, what? Cooking? Butter and egg? Like, I feel like that's probably one of the better ways to cook an egg. It's better than oil, even though butter's not very good for you. Butter tastes delicious. So, like, what is a butter and egg man? Like, I was so like, what the fuck? So, a butter and egg man is somebody who's a wealthy man, but from a small community, but he's not very smart. And when he goes into a large community, he acts like a playboy and throws his money around to act like he's from a big boy, I guess. So that's butter and egg man. And I don't understand how that's connected. And if anybody wants to try to explain that to me and tell me how butter and eggs have anything to do with poor people going to the big city, that'd be cool. Because I don't fucking get it. So here's some dead words. The first one is just wonderful. Expurgafactor. Expurgafactor. Sounds like some sort of transformer or like the weapon for some sort of sci-fi creature. But an expurgafactor is anything that wakes you up. So your alarm clock is actually an expurgafactor. Your screaming child at 3:00 in the morning is an expurgafactor. If you wake up with incessant diarrhea or you drank way too much alcohol the night before, those are pre-expurgafactors. So beware. I really like this one. A staddle. So it has nothing to do with horses. It has a T in there. Staddle. And it's the depression left in your bed when you get up out of it. And you turn around, you see where you're laying. That's your staddle. So vomitorium. It does nothing to do with puking. A vomitorium is an exit from a building, especially public buildings such as theaters or bathhouses. All right. So let's look into evolution. So this was off of a website I really liked. It was called Culture Trip. And it had some really cool factors. So, awful, the old English word awe initially meant bad, like a fearful or a terrible experience or something that just really like makes your gut turn. Like that was like, oh, maybe that's, ugh. But at some point it morphed into solemn reverential wonder. Like you see a rainbow and you're just like, oh my God, that's a triple rainbow. That was like that reverential wonder. It went from just like being something awful, like a fucking chupacabra, to rainbow. And then another time, and then it became synonymous with like just like inspiring, like awesome, like that the exclamation mark, like that feeling. So now we've gone from just something that's like literally dog shit on the road to awesome. And then it later morphed into a completely bad connotation. So at some point it went from awesome. So awful used to be like, that's fucking awful. Like, I just got a bunch of gold. To now, awful is like, it's a bad. Like, it's like that was awful. I've had an awful day. It's one of my strongest words. Like, if I'm trying to describe something, like if I've had a bad day, like, awful's like I've had an awful day. Like that's serious. So I was actually really surprised by all of that information. That was all new incoming information to me. So flirt. Initially this meant to give a blow or to sneer at a person. Like to flirt somebody, like I flirted you in the shoulder. I have no idea how we got from that to meaning hitting on somebody. Oh, hitting on somebody. Because you're hitting on them. Oh. Is it really just pun? Could we really be just living a pun and nobody knows that it's a massive pun? Like we're boxing people when we're making advances towards them. Oh, advancing? I get it. It's we're turning all these weird social interactions into like a fight sequence, which for some people, I guess it is if you're being that competitive. So this one was really fun. So nice began as a word to describe the ignorant. It was a derogatory term for stupid or foolish people. At some point, it morphed to mean a shy or a friendly person. And then it got another step up to mean a refined and polite person. And some people think nice actually is becoming a bad word again. And I don't really understand that. At least I haven't caught up with those social cues yet. But still very cool. You know, all in all, very, very cool. You know, like, it just shows you how, like, and English is a bit, but there's so many different languages. There's like 500 countries on this world, people. And most of those countries have, you know, like China's got like tens of dialects. You know, there's an island in Papua New Guinea where I think every tribe had a different dialect. You know, like, we can't understand Creole people if you're in the United States. Sorry if I just said we, and if you're listening from outside the United States. But it's just, there's so much language, and it's so just very liquid, flexible. Like, it's so augmentable, and you know, like, it changes so quickly, and every single individual has such a personality that imbue into your language. It's just, it's very, very, very strange. All right, so let's swing back out of linguistics into some more Ludwig. Can we know anything? If it's possible to doubt our language, which is a very uncertain thing, because this is how I'm communicating with you, I'm banking my soul on the fact that you can understand what I think and feel by my words traveling into a digital transmitter, going through wires and cables, and then electromagnetic waves, maybe to satellites, maybe, and then like my words are traveling through so many different weird mediums just to reach your ears. And I'm banking on my words to be strong enough to actually convey something, or else it wouldn't even be worth the time to do it. And every single person who talks makes that wager. So we are very certain in language. And I feel the certainty in our words is almost comparative to the certainty in our body's parts. Often, the way that we can communicate is very, or our personalities that we communicate through language, we have to have some sort of conviction in that, similar to our hand, you know, like, and that begins to bring up massive doubt, you know, and you start to think about, you know, if I can doubt language, what else can I doubt? And if you've been proven wrong, you know, and I feel like everybody's been proven wrong before, I damn sure have, where I've had massive conviction, even in arguments where I'm like, this is where I'm fucking putting my foot down. And you're like, most of the time, I'll prove myself wrong the next day because that's set up a little time bomb where my brain is automatically ticking like, oh, really? You know, you think you're the shit, right? You know, well, we're going to figure it out and figure out how you're wrong. And that's a very healthy thing, I think, because if I held too much conviction, my arrogance would never let me be a full human being. And I would never be able to talk and express my feelings fully if I always had to hold the fort. You know? I hope you do. When you're proven wrong, can that be disturbing? You know, not just the logical symptom of, oh, I was wrong, I got to change my feelings and thoughts on this. But is there a negative feeling like in your stomach where you're like, ugh, you get a kind of a sick feeling because you know that you were wrong? And that's one of those things that you kind of know. You might not know what you were trying to express, but you know when you hear something that is so counter, and then you're like, yeah, yep, that's right. And fuck, you know, like I did that. Nope. That's how I go. I'm like, shit. And then, like, gotta figure out how not to let that happen again. Because this is my brain. my feelings, you know. I'm going to use that word a lot tonight, feelings. You know, feelings is okay. You know, having feelings is part of being human. So I hope you are feeling tonight as well. So, back again. This role-playing that we do. Logic itself and the way that we compare things. So, logic, If A is B, then it's impossible for A not to be B. That's logic. If A plus B equals C, then B plus A has to equal C too. It doesn't matter how you move it around, identity theory. You know, so a lot of this can go back to math too, but we're putting these mathematical identity principles into like logic ideas, like all humans are animals. If that's a human, he has to be an animal. That's logic too. And this is deductive logic, you know? So like logic itself. And then, you know, I'm expressing it with a lot of conviction right now, because this is how I run my life too. You know, if I push this gas pedal, it's going to fucking work. Like we have these little loops, these logic loops that we run by, you know, and a lot of them, some of them are more abstract. Some people have crazy logics, but is it role playing again? Are we playing more rules? Like these rules of language, these rules of words, these rules of being, you know? And if there is a game that has rules that we are playing, who's the game maker? And how many people are playing the game? So Lude depicts flat earth in a section, and he does it at first, and I was like, oh shit. And I was like, he's a flat earther. Like, cause it just like, he reeks of skepticism, but he's not. He's weird. I think he's just expressing all the arguments in their full from as many different angles as possible. So at first I'm like, oh no, he's a flat earther. And then a couple pages later, I'm like, oh shit. I have this, like, he has to be doing satire, because he was showing how somebody could take the logic. But in the same way, it was such a double-edged sword, because he's saying we have this strong conviction that the earth's not flat. You know, like, I don't think the earth isn't flat. You know, the earth seems like a globe. A lot of humans have thought about it. A lot of humans have got to that conclusion. I know that's groupthink, but it's one of it's the closest thing outside my body to as being certain about my hand, is that some of these, the physics of our world, the planet, the way it spins, or how the fuck will we get around on airplanes, shipping, you know, there's so many things entangled into it, you know, at what point that like it's very hard for me to accept that the earth is flat. And so he's doing that too, because he's expressing the flat earth element, and he's also expressing how ludicrous it is to have absolute conviction in something outside our body, you know, because at the end of the day, it's entirely impossible to prove absolute certainty. I think there's always shades of gray, and I will never be the one to claim that there's a 0 or 100% probability for things to come across that way. Which is another thing that Lude brings up. So he talks about the probability of certainty, you know, like not just degrees of certainty, but when we're being certain about something, when I say, yeah, that's a tree over there, you know, that means that there's like a 60% chance because of that degree too. Maybe it's on the scale. So when we're very, very certain, this is my hand, you know, maybe I would go 99.99999999999. But I would always hesitate to say with 100% certainty, you know, that. I guess that makes me does sound mad. I sound mad to myself when I doubt my own hand. One of the stories that Wig does is he says, he's like, nobody's been to the moon yet, because it's like 1930 something, you know? So he's like, nobody's been to the moon yet, but I could have been abducted in my sleep and not even known it. So I might've been to the moon and I wouldn't know it. You know, like if you're abducted by aliens, or maybe you forgot, you went to the moon and you forgot, and you have no way of knowing that you forgot. Like, so there's, and that sounds ludicrous, but it's just like the flat earth. Like, it's a scary place to be, to realm into those levels of scary doubt, of doubting everything. And it's a very thin line you walk, but there's definitely probability involved, you know. And everything, the more certain we are about something, that means that it's more likely in a set of times it's going to happen. If it's more likely to happen in a set of times, it's more likely to happen in the moment that you experience it. So if you're very certain about something, you're playing those gambling games in your head, and you're flipping the coins, and you're like, okay, good enough chance, I'm going to bank on it, and I'm going to believe this now. So there's also a pragmatic approach to how we use certainty within that probability. So pragmatism is usefulness. I'm not going to go buy really expensive shit because it's expensive and it'll make me have more esteem in my community if I can get something cheaper, because that's more pragmatic, and then I can use my money for something better. I don't work ridiculous amount of hours because I don't need to, and I can, and we can live within our means at that certain point, me and my son being that we. So if we're unsure about our knowing, how do we doubt? What is the source of doubt? Is it another feeling? Just like that feeling of conviction, that feeling of rightness? Is doubt just another feeling that we get when we're approached with new incoming information, where you get that uplifting, yeah, I agree with that, when somebody says something you like, even if it's new, and you get that gut clenching, eh, I doubt that. Is doubt the opposite of rightness? Is doubt synonymous with uncertainty? I'm not sure. What makes us? Is it, if it's an emotion that gives us these convictions of right or wrong, and not wrong in the essence of judgment, but wrong in the essence of doubting information. And there's always the chance that something else is going to come along that sounds better and flip doubt into certainty. Because what if a couple connections back something you doubted, and then you start getting new information, and you learn something that a puzzle piece a couple steps back, you don't doubt any longer. Does that trigger a cascade of new beliefs? Maybe. If we can doubt things, and many people doubt things, there's always a small percentage that are going to believe it. Does that mean that we're really pegging on or looking for a universal? Are we sensing something that's universally true? Or are we all just drinking the Kool-Aid and believing the same thing? Groupthink. I feel like this should be pretty common. I think it's talked about a lot. I feel like I heard about it in high school, especially in like a lot of my social work classes. Groupthink is a phenomena where if you put a lot of people in the same room, I think they did this test once where they had, like, I did it in a psychology class where it was a piece of paper with three lines, and the teacher asked which line's the shortest. And there was a plant, like the person who was running, the student who was running the test was in on it. And so they would point to the wrong answer. Or they talk, I don't remember. But the point is that, you know, you have these people who are very sure that the answer that they have in their head is different from what everybody else is choosing. And so they look around and everybody's saying, that's the line that is the shortest. And in your head, you're like, no, that line looks pretty long, but everybody else seems to think it's not. So I would feel uncomfortable to not vote this way or not think that that line's shorter. And so then all of a sudden they change their conviction just to suit the people around them. And that's this groupthink. And so is the essence of all these rightnesses, is that related to the majority's group consciousness? You know, like there's always like this under vibe that I don't think is completely perpetrated by a whole bunch of like, you know, Cruella de Vils. I'm very hesitant to say there's a secret cabal ruling the world. You know, maybe, you know, I'm never going to say 0 to 100. You know, it's always a possibility. You know, but it just seems more likely to me that there is a subliminal group consciousness and that our species is incredibly ignorant, and that groupthink is like a child and doesn't want to get better yet. And that's why we keep making these dumbass decisions. So is rightness related to the majority? Is the feeling of rightness, is the feeling of certainty, is it just related to what's most commonly thought? And is that why it evolves? And when we change our mind, is that sensed to the group consciousness changing its mind? I'm not sure. These are murky waters. Very strange mind that brought up all these ideas. And he had a profound effect on our species and across multiple languages. And if I had access to a time traveling machine, this is one of those people that I want to talk to. He is immense when it comes to what he offered to the scale of philosophy and the areas of mind and the areas of science, history, and I think it's epistemology. Yeah, epistemology. would be the philosophy of considering how we know things in the first place, like bare bones. So, we got groupthink, you know? What does the word reasonable mean? That's reasonable. Sounds good, right? It's just another synonym, maybe. Or does it have a layer of depth that separates it from certainty and that separates it from rightness and separates it from conviction? Does reasonable relate to the majority in groupthink? You know, a lot of times, you know, I read it somewhere. I read this in a journal. So all of a sudden, I might not know that person. I don't know the studies they did. I didn't look into their bibliography and cross-check all their thoughts. But I took it on faith that I trusted the sample matter. And then I approach it with somebody and I say, I read this and this is what it said. And I believe it. And so now I'm perpetuating this idea. And I'm trying to sell it. You know, like, and I'm really bad about this because I listen to podcasts all the time. It's my favorite pastime. I listen to all kinds of shows. Crowd Science, Bad People is great. Morbid is great. You know, Big Picture Science. So I listen to all these podcasts constantly, and I bring it up a lot. And, you know, like, I heard this on a podcast. I heard this on a scientific podcast. And a lot of the stuff I listen to does come, like, BiPiSci, Big Picture Science is run out of the SETI Institute. So they're pretty good science. You know, like, that's, you could, they always put out all of their research that they use, the people they talk to, they make it very accessible. You know, and, like, I love quoting those people. You know, sometimes I quote some, like, sketchy shit. You know, like, and it sounded good to me, and it felt good enough inside me that I felt okay to share it with others, almost to the point that it was a compulsion to share it with others because it's like almost it felt good to learn new something that felt good in me. I'm like, I want to put that in somebody else in the least rapey way possible. But, like, it's strange. So I'm going to get into three different analogies for how we relate these beliefs, because it's never just one belief, right? These beliefs amalgamate off of these sensible propositions that we talk about. They predicate off each other, right? Right? So we'll start with a house. You know, can you build a house without a foundation? Which is one of these ideas we get about certainty, is we're always digging back. We always try to reduce reductionism within that material. You know, what is our bodies made out of? Muscles, organs. And what are those organs made out of? Tissues. What are those tissues made out of? Cells. What are those cells made out of? Atoms. You know, we reduce. And that's sort of this principle of what's the foundations of the house. And you can do the same things anatomically that you can to ideas if you think hard enough. You know, like, why do I think that's a cat? Well, mom told me it's a cat. Dad told me it's a cat. You know, all cats have those weird faces. They're kind of triangular. They have weird tails. They like to scratch children. You know, like, so you start to dig back. Where's the foundation for these beliefs? You know, what's the last thing that I believe that made me feel this way? Right? So that's a good one. Another one that Lude brings up is called the nest of propositions, which really good. The nest holds tract because you have to go gather beliefs. So you physically have to go leave the nest and bring things back that you want to build this nest up. And the other thing about a nest is it's a home. You know, this is where your babies go. You know, your ideas have babies, these strong beliefs that yield feelings, that yield, you know, positivity or comfort in life or ways to deal with life. You know, like, I feel like many people would be protective of their nest. What's your nest egg? What's the money you saved up so that you could depend upon it? These are your beliefs you depend upon, right? So that's part of it as well. And then my favorite is the web of interconnected propositions of belief. So it's not just redness that really pushes me. Oh, that's red. Oh, cool. Red has always been very persuasive to me. So the fact that you brought up the color of red makes me believe you. No, it's because apples are circular. You know, let's talk about apples. I really like apples. So apples, I'm going to use red apples. I know there's green ones and all kinds of really marbled ones. But imagine you're in a place that has only ever had red apples. So Proposition one, apples are red, apples are sweet, apples grow on trees. These are three propositions. Apples have a certain texture that I'm aware of. I know that they don't hurt me. Maybe those are dependent upon other propositions. We're getting into shadier webs. But all the things about it, it's not the redness that compels me that this is an apple. Not even just the sweetness. There's other things that's sweet. It's the fact that it's red and it's sweet, and these things are in congruency together in the same moment, you know. That's what really leads me to think that that's an apple. So the web of interconnected propositions of belief is that things become stronger the more beliefs you tag on to something, you know, such as I brought up globe Earth earlier. You know, how would planes get around? How would boats get around? How are we doing all this shipping? How do we have satellites? If satellites don't exist, how are we getting all this information around? Why? Why would people really risk all that? It seems really like the stupidest way to fucking run the world. You know, like, why wouldn't we just live on a flat Earth and know it? You know, like, why wouldn't it be incredibly obvious? These are all these propositions that build upon each other and really strengthen my conviction in that one idea. Not all the way to 100. You know, maybe there it's flat. Maybe I could be proven wrong. You know, that'd be cool. You know, like, but the more things you have on the central spoke, if there is a foundation, maybe it's a spokeless wheel, you know, an empty tire, you know, but the more things you have hanging on something, the stronger the probability and the stronger your conviction is going to be in it. And probably the more useful it's going to be too for pragmatic value. So one of the things that I think about apples that I brought up a lot, it's one of my favorite analogies. Math is something that people love to say is uncontestable, that math can't be proven wrong. Math might be the language that describes reality, you know, and math is definitely a language that's highly accurate and isn't as subject to as much evolutionary change as our symbology and our words. And we're able to describe things with math very well because it's so abstract. And one of the things that I like to use to try to prove how abstract this concept is the idea of a unit. What's a unit? A unit is one. You know, one plus one equals two. I have a hard time doubting that abstract principle. One and one equal two. Without decimals, without anything, within mathematics, very strict and very concrete and very stable rules, one and one equals two. However, when we bring out that proposition into the real world, one, what is one? If I have two apples in my hands, in the world, there's never a perfect apple. And it's not like a tree is going to grow 100 apples on its branches that are all identically correct. That doesn't happen. So if I weighed both these apples, they'd weigh slightly different. They might be slightly different pigments of red. They might be slightly different flavor profiles. One might have a worm in it, you know? So if I'm holding two apples and we're playing with this abstract mathematical principle, one and one equals two, it'd be weird if I said, this isn't two apples. How do I know this is two apples? Well, yeah, it's two apples. But which apple is one apple? Like, would you have to shave off a piece of one and add it to the other to make them equal? Would they be equal anymore after that manipulation? It's a center of doubt again, right? One of the things that Wick says is, our task gets its meaning from the rest of proceedings. And I like that because it kind of rhymes. Our task gets its meaning from the rest of proceedings. Sorry, I'm not really good at singing. But our task, transmitting data, getting our feelings across, getting our ideas across, gets its meaning from the rest of its proceedings. So it's how things are interlaid together that gives them relevance too. So he has this timing interval principle. You know, like, if we're talking, you know, I come up and I meet you and, you know, I don't say hi. And then we just jump right into conversation. You think that's awkward at first, but you blow it off because, you know, I'm kind of weird. So we've been talking for about 6 or 7 minutes and all of a sudden I go, good morning. Hi. Right in the middle of conversation. That'd feel real weird, real fucking awkward, right? So how well we get our meaning across definitely has a very strong lean on the timing and how we express things. And timing is everything. Timing is key. Time and place. Laying our dominoes in the right correction, in the right line, the right configuration, so that they do work right, you know. Do children doubt? I don't think children naturally doubt until they catch you in a lie. I think that's where doubt arises from in children, is the first time that they realize something that their parents said, which is their primary dominant belief source that they get everything from. Most children have complete faith in their parents, I would assume, unless they've been damaged. So it's when you've been, when you notice that they're not Superman or Superwoman anymore, that's where you start to doubt. And I've always been a very doubtful little human, to the point of arrogance, especially in my childhood. There was very rarely a teacher that had a strong enough willpower that in the back of my head, I wasn't disagreeing with them, or I wasn't raising my hand to put out points that I'd heard from somebody else that was in opposition to them. So I was being a little polemic and a little skeptic in my childhood, I feel like, even though I had a very natural bend towards science, and I did believe science. Science was God to me. You know. The last point I want to bring up about Wig, before I read a couple lines from him and maybe just bullshit for a second, kind of related to the timingness, is the ludicrousness of obvious statements. So, like, the hand, let's go back to the hand. I approach you. Don't even say hi. First thing I says, this is my hand. I look you in the eye. Very passionate about it. Be pretty fucking weird, right? Well, duh. That's your hand. Why are you bringing it up? Because it's so obvious that even though it's not your hand, the certainty is in the air, to the point that you might doubt my sanity or doubt your own sanity if you start approaching people like, this is my hand. This is my shirt. See my shirt? You know, like, it's just like I guess children kind of do it. I think it's a very normal thing for children to do, which makes you think. Or children will come up to somebody and be like, this is my shirt. Look at my hand. Maybe because they're learning these things, and maybe it hasn't formed yet, little children. Maybe that tells you something. Very strange. All right. Let's get to some of his words, just so you can hear a little bit more what he said. So this is section number 44. If you demand a rule from which it follows that there can't have been a miscalculation here, the answer is that we did not learn this through a rule, but by learning to calculate. So, I had this pieced out like a while ago, but now that I read it again, I'm already confused again. So, calculation is the playing of the logic game. It's not, and so I think what he's doing is he's doubting that inherent rule, because we learned the calculation game, the logic game. So, yeah, you take what you will. I'm going to have to think on that again. So the thing about this fucker is, like, I thought I had that down. That's why I highlighted it, because I was, like, really proud of it, and then I read it, and I'm like, I don't know what this means. All right. So, section number 137. Even if the most trustworthy of men assures me that he knows things are thus and so, this by itself cannot satisfy me that he does know, only that he believes he knows. Bam. I like it. That's a good one right there. Basically, he's saying that when you get approached by somebody, all right, this is a good one. I'm gonna digress on this a little bit. I think I've talked about this, especially in my Farabend episode, intellectual agnosticism, you know, which my kung fu teacher, Sensei, he put out, I think he calls it the Scholastic Way, the way of the scholar, and the monks, the ones who were allowed to have the swords in ancient China, you know, they acted as marshals, police, but they were the readers, they were the monks, you know, like the Scholastic Way is to be able to entertain an idea, to be able to hold it, but not really have to accept it or identify with it, which kind of helped me formulate it. Part of how I feel about what I'm calling intellectual agnosticism, being able to refrain judgment about anything and expecting the opposite to necessarily have to exist. And I think that's kind of what Wig's getting at, is that anybody can approach me and tell me something that doesn't give me proof that that's reality. It means that you believe it. And if you believe it, then it's possible to me. Because I suspend judgment and I'm very agnostic to all ideas, even flat earth, even if it's 0.00001%. I digress. Oh, no. All right. Let's see here. If I can find my pages. 237. If I say an hour ago this table didn't exist, I probably mean that it was only made later on. If I say this mountain didn't exist then, I presumably mean that it was only formed later on, perhaps by a volcano. If I say this mountain didn't exist half an hour ago, that is such a strange statement that it is not clear what I mean. Whether, for example, I mean something untrue, but scientific. Perhaps you think that the statement that the mountain didn't exist then is quite clear. However, one conceives the context. But suppose someone said, this mountain didn't exist a minute ago, but an exactly similar one did instead. Only the accustomed context allows when it means to come through clearly. Timing, relevance, absurdity. Sorry, I kind of spangled back there too. It was a long one. All right. 467. I'm sitting with a philosopher in the garden. He says again and again, I know that that's a tree, pointing to a tree that is near us. Someone else arrives and hears this, and I tell him, this fellow is not insane. We are only doing philosophy. Fucking brilliant. Like, don't worry. We're not doubting reality, we're just philosophizing. Last quote for the night, sorry. Number 115. If you tried to doubt everything, you would not get as far as doubting anything. The game of doubting itself presupposes certainty. Fucking mic drop right there. If you want to be a complete skeptic and have that be a part of your individuality, part of your personality, is I doubt everything. Reality is nothing existent. Nihilistic knowledge is impossible to know, and you can never do it because we're stupid. You know, like, to suppose that game and to suppose that nothing's real is to suppose, to doubt it, supposes that you're looking for something, that you're seeking for the answer. So to have a conviction that it's not right means that you are doing some sort of future telling to suppose that it could be, which... Is it not correct to doubt that you could change your mind? Like in an argument, you know, like if in an argument I was to be as blatant to say, it is literally impossible for you to give me any information, or just simply, you know, like it's impossible for you to change my mind. If I were to say that to you, you cannot change my mind. It's impossible. That is a fortune-telling statement. You are sitting in the box with your hand on that weird fucking fake glass globe, and you're literally telling that person, I can tell the future because I can see into all the bajillion frames of things that are going to happen to me in the next decades before I die. And in all those decades that I can somehow see, I'm omnipresently like a fucking god of reality. And none of those things, none of those new ideas are ever going to change my mind. That's a powerful statement to say. You cannot change my mind, or it's impossible for me to change my mind. You know? Like, and I would feel very sad in a way. All right. So that was a deep, deep, deep dive. I hope you made it through. I tried to make it fun. I really loved it. You know, I have a supreme man crush on this dead guy. You know, like, his ideas are just fucking awesome to me. And I'm going to continue thinking about him, and I'm going to reread this book. You know, it's falling apart. I got it. It's old as shit. And, like, as I was going, it was falling apart page by page, which is why I was cursing back there, is because I'm leafing through individual pagelets looking for page numbers. And, like, I'm going to get more. I want to get the Tractatus Philosophicus. I freaking forgot what it was called. But I'm going to get that one soon. I'm going to read more of him. I'm going to read more of his sources. I'm going to get into more Bertrand Russell. He was a contemporary and heavily motivated by Bertrand Russell. And it was very important to me. And I was very nervous all day. This was a lot of pressure. I got like 4 pages of notes here. I hope I wasn't too clunky. Like, I really wanted to make sure that I didn't forget too many important ideas that had moved me, that I've been thinking about over the past couple weeks. And I hope it has some sort of positive effect. And, you know, if you want to email me and talk about any of these things, or if you need help finding ways to obtain these resources, you can email me at Brandon, B-R-A-N-D-O-N, W as in walrus, V as in Victor, O-G-T, at gmail.com. You can also find me at the Gingerbread Man Dialogues, that's the handle on Facebook, or you can look up my Facebook page, The Gingerbread Man. I'm going to work on getting all that other stupid social media bullshit, you know, not because I want to push publicity and make it huge, but I want to make it easier to communicate with other people, and I want this to be an open forum where hopefully if I can get people talking and make my own Stoa Poleka, where people could just start having open conversation. Like, maybe I'll make my own social media someday. I don't know. But just open conversation, open expression of creativity, open expression of passions. Those are all very important. And if you need somebody to talk to, I'm here. Always. Our sponsor today was Certainty, obviously. You can find certainty by analyzing how you judge others. If you become overwhelmed by certainty, simply take a nap or knock yourself out by running into a wall. And if at any point you start to doubt all of reality, just remember that the fact that you are doubting all of reality is only because you feel there is some ultimate certainty that you are looking for. Thank you so much. If you're at this end part and you're hearing my sappy little, you're important, you know, and I mean it, every single one of you, you know, selfishly, I'm important, you know, my son is important, our species is important, my houseplants are important, life and all of reality is a beautiful, wonderful, just crazy fucked up puzzle that I'm not sure we're ever going to build all the way. But it is important. Your world is important, and how you feel. And I hope that you can give yourself a hug. And you know that tomorrow, when you get up and you go out, you are going to be doing great work. And that's fucking amazing. And I'm so glad to have you here. Thank you for listening. Hope you have a great night.